Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
A really sweet, heartwarming one from NPR, just to kick us off. A dog traveled nearly 4 miles to get help after its owner crashed into a ravine.
4 miles. Wow.
Yeah, 4 miles to the campsite where the man was staying with family.
So he wasn't just like randomly looking. He was like, no, I know where to go and I got to get there.
Yes.
Wow.
So a man was driving with his 4 dogs on a remote U.S. Forest Service when he crashed into the ravine below. His family located his car the following day. They called 911 as they couldn't reach it. The terrain was that steep.
Oof.
And when authorities arrived, they found the man about 100 yards from the car after they heard him yell for help. He had luckily been able to crawl out of the car after the crash, and it was a huge rescue effort. They used chainsaws to clear a path through the vegetation, then set up a complete rope system that was super complex. It went from one side of the ravine to the other, and in this entire scene, there is a stream raging below. Like, it was super hazardous. It kind of ends with, I don't know, not enough information for me. The man was airlifted to a regional hospital. His 3 other dogs were found alive at the scene of the crash.
Okay, that was my big question there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know there's going to be some favoritism now, though. Like, the 3 dogs who didn't help him and the one who did.
Listen, they may have been injured.
Right.
Well, what's amazing about that, right, is had the dog not gone back to that campsite,
yes,
it would have just been picked up by animal control and that dude would still be there.
Right. The dog did need to go somewhere specific. Yeah.
Very specific, right? To show up and be like, why are you here? And where is everybody else?
Right.
The specificity of a campsite, credit to dogs and their amazing sense of smell, right?
Well, and maybe there was some directional, like some animals are very good at knowing directions as well.
Right.
Listen, those details hardly even matter because
right. That
dog is a hero.
You
have a dog, give that dog a treat. And if you don't have a dog, consider getting one.
That's right, because you could go off a ravine at any minute.
You
need a dog
know.
With you.
You never know.
Okay, next link.
This comes from the BBC. The cement that could turn your house into a giant battery.
Ooh.
Yeah, let's paint the scene. On a laboratory bench in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a stack of polished cylinders of black-colored concrete sit bathed in a liquid and entwined in cables.
Huh.
Those cables are attached to an LED. Then Damien Stefanwick flicks a switch and the light lights up. He said he didn't believe it. He thought that he hadn't disconnected the power source. So he invited all students and other professors to see. And at first, they didn't believe it worked either. It was a wonderful day, he said. And why all the excitement over a dark lump of concrete? I mean, as you can imagine, this could solve some of the battery issues we currently have.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know how to harness power from the sun, water, wind. But again, it's been the storing of that that's been the biggest hurdle to clean energy. Batteries rely on lithium, which is in far shorter supply than is likely to be needed to meet mm-hmm. the demand. Also, environmental analysis, as well as, let's call them petroleum advocates, note that lithium mining uses a lot of energy and water, which eats away at all those environmental benefits and credibility of switching to renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask all my oil business relatives.
Right.
They'll let you know. And hopefully, this new concrete will solve those problems. And I hear you saying, yeah, okay, but concrete is terrible for the environment. And you're ahead of the article, and we'll get to that in a moment. So let's get back to the concrete first. The team at MIT have found a way to create an energy storage device known as a supercapacitor from 3 basic cheap materials, water, cement, and a soot-like substance called carbon black.
Hmm.
Of course, they're envisioning future applications already, like roads that store solar energy and then release it to recharge electrical cars as they drive down the road.
Hmm.
Or Another would be as energy storing foundations of houses. And as for most things we talk about on this podcast, it's early days.
Right, yeah. Right.
For now, it can store a little under 300 watts per cubic meter. That's enough to power a 10-watt LED for about 30 hours. So it's not much.
Yeah.
But they did scale it up enough for him to play a Game Boy.
Hey!
They didn't say how long, but he did play the Game Boy.
All right.
So how does this concrete work? It gets pretty technical in the article, so I'll sum it up the best I can. Carbon black is highly conductive. When carbon black is combined with cement powder and water, it makes a kind of concrete that's full of networks of conductive material, kind of like branches and tiny roots.
Huh.
For those that don't know, capacitors are formed when two conductive plates have a membrane jammed in between them. So stick two plates made of carbon black in potassium chloride, which is a conductive liquid, with the concrete in the middle, and voila, you got a battery.
Well, so I guess you'd have to have potassium chloride as part of your foundation?
Yes. You'd have liquid in there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Little pockets of liquid in my foundation. Okay.
Or little batteries, if you will.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there are issues to overcome. Adding the carbon black to concrete makes it weaker.
Mm.
Or how crappy is that concrete for the environment?
Yeah. What happens when it's raining and all of
everybody
that?
Everybody gets electrocuted.
Yeah. Aside from like, don't ever spill a drink on your walls.
And currently, too, concrete makes up 5 to 8% of CO2 emissions, so it's not great for the environment.
But here's the thing, though. Aesthetically, they would be so much more pleasing if you had the goth house on the block with the black foundation.
It would be nice, because, oh, yeah, we've got some black houses here that they've just put up, and I question, like, what's wrong with you? So we'll see what becomes of this, but it is a neat step in the right direction, at least for me.
Yeah, any future battery tech is going to be helpful, because we're going to have mm-hmm. to, as we shift away from combustibles, we have to find a way to store the energy that's quite abundant. But that's the issue, is how can we store it and use it?
Yeah, fill that Tesla with concrete. Run real fast.
Yeah, that'll be
what
fine.
A statement.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I am super excited to talk about this next one because it's about a new documentary that I just happened to watch right before this article got posted. And let me say just right now, I am not an unbiased source on this. The documentary is amazing. Everybody should go watch it. And somebody at the BBC clearly thought so, too, because they wrote this article, which is called Naked, Alone, and Living on Dog Food, All for a TV Show That Gripped a Nation.
Oh, this is, okay, I already know. Oh,
did you see it too?
You watched
no,
it?
No, I haven't seen it, but this is, it's the Japanese show, yes?
Yes, yes. Okay. So the TV show in question was called A Life in Prizes, and it was a recurring segment on a larger variety show in Japan called Denpa Shonen. And it's really hard to overstate just how influential this show was for the time, because it was truly one of the first reality shows. A Life in Prizes began airing in 1998, which was a year before Big Brother first premiered in the Netherlands and 2 years before the first season of Survivor in the US. Ooh. And to be fair, it is true that The Real World and a few others like it had been airing for several years by then. But the key shift here is that shows like The Real World just put people in a house and filmed their normal interactions, whereas this new wave of shows required their contestants to go through specific artificial challenges.
More on the lines of like almost the Truman Show-ish.
Yes. And they also note this was a couple years before the Truman Show as well. And I feel like whoever wrote the Truman Show definitely was aware of
this
other show at the time. Yeah, for sure.
Oof.
So the challenge for A Life in Prizes was to see if someone could live on nothing but mail-in sweepstakes. Because at the time, it was a really common thing in Japan for companies to run little prize giveaways in magazines as a way to collect customer information. So you would see an ad for dog food, for example, and at the bottom it would say, send us a postcard with your name and address, and one lucky winner will receive a month's worth supply of our great product. So the Denpa Shonen producer who masterminded the segment was a guy named Toshio Tsuchiya,
also known as Beelzebub in some other corners of the world.
Oh, yeah. Like, even now, in his interview segments in the documentary, he's like, yeah, it was maybe a little mean, but it made great TV. Like, he feels no guilt about what happened. Yeah. And he absolutely should, because as will soon become apparent, he pushed it way too far. He straight up lied to the people auditioning for this show about what it was going to be. So the contestant they chose was an aspiring comedian who went by the name Nasubi, which means eggplant, because his jaw is very prominent and he was sort of leaning into that as part of his comedy brand. And that is worth noting that he was fundamentally a performer. He was trying to be on TV, and he did understand that he was supposed to do kind of crazy things for entertainment purposes. But he was not prepared for it when they took him into a room and said, give us all your clothes because you didn't win those in a sweepstakes. And Nasubi was like, well, hang on. And they told him, oh, no, 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 don't worry. This is all going to be like B-roll footage for another show. Probably no one's ever even going to see it. And of course, we're going to blur the graphic bits. And that first part was a lie. This was absolutely going to be seen by a ton of people because Denpa Shonen was already one of the most popular television shows at the time. And also, instead of blurring, they decided it would be cute to put a little eggplant emoji over his groin whenever it was on camera.
Is that?
Yes.
That's the, oh my God, the origin story of why eggplant emoji means what it does in common parlance?
100%. Because his name meant eggplant, and everybody in Japan started using the cute little eggplant in this show to mean his genitalia specifically, and that's where it spread from.
I am humbled at this, like...
cultural appropriation?
No!
Just kidding.
It was like a puzzle piece just slot in for me.
Well, yeah, because there's always been this like, oh, it's the shape of, I'm like, it's not really.
No.
Like, why?
No. Right, yeah, why not a pickle or something else?
Yeah, the Japanese led the way.
As they often do in all things related to, never mind. Go on, please.
Exactly, yes. So another thing that Nasubi didn't understand when he began was that all of his food was going to have to come from prizes too. Now, you know, clearly they couldn't just let him die, so they did give him a small ration of crackers each day until he won his first food prize. But after that, they were like, you're on your own. And it didn't matter if what he won was dog food or uncooked rice and he didn't have a pot to cook it in. He just had to make do.
Mm-hmm.
And anything he won joined him in the room, including, among other things, a stack of car tires, a globe, a teddy bear, and tickets to Spice World the movie.
Wow.
Which again, 1998. And when he did win these prizes, he was very big and dramatic and funny about it, dancing around the room and doing like silly prop jokes. But the end result of that was that even people who were sort of uncomfortable with the show's premise were like, well, see, he's having fun. He's doing okay. But in fact, Nasubi was sinking into a deep depression the other 99% of the time when he was sitting alone and naked, just filling out postcards 12 hours a day.
Right. The true B-roll that ended up on the floor was him wanting to die.
Yes, very much so.
His life choices.
Yeah, because the camera was just in the room. There were no people other than the producers would knock on the door when he won a prize and hand it to him. And I don't want to spoil the whole thing because there is way more to this story and you really do need to watch the documentary. But in total, Nasubi spent 15 months in isolation filming for this show. And throughout the process, they were screwing him over as a performer as well as a human being. Because Nasubi, in his youth and ignorance, never signed a contract of any kind.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my friend.
Whoa.
Oh. Uh-huh. He was paid almost nothing, despite the show bringing in millions and millions of dollars in advertising, which, again, he had no idea. Like, his parents were watching him dance around naked on national TV every week, and they couldn't even tell him it was happening. The production company even published and sold copies of his diaries that he was writing the entire time he was in there, which they encouraged him to do and which he never saw a penny from. So... obviously, it's 25 years later now, and Nasubi has a lot of thoughts about what he went through as a young performer and how it's affected his life. And there are obviously a lot of parallels drawn in the documentary between this one spectacle and the absolute plethora of competition shows that exist today, not to mention social media for the rest of us. Like, what is this doing to us? Are we all a little Nasubi, you know?
Yeah. We all, as spectators,
right,
also became participant in it to some degree because we have allowed those kinds of conditions to persist.
Well, and there's a little bit of that even now. Like, as I'm watching it, I'm like, am I participating in what's happening to him again now? Like, this is being dragged up. And am I, by watching it, making it worse? And the only thing I could console myself with was no, because the documentary maker of this, it's called The Contestant, is very sympathetic to Nasubi. And I have to believe in my heart that they this time gave him a contract with percentage residuals. And that so by watching it, I'm ensuring that he finally gets paid.
Mm-hmm.
But what Netflix is so good at, as we've seen with things like Baby Reindeer and even Serial, right, is using this media not to act as a capstone or an end, but it actually starts a new chapter.
Well, to be fair, this one isn't on Netflix. It's on Hulu. But but the point still stands, I think. The streaming services have their own motivation. And all I can hope is that the documentary maker herself was able to secure some kind of benefit for right. Nasubi, who is still alive and living his life and doing like a bunch of charity work. It is very heartbreaking, but it is also heartwarming in the end. Like, yeah, I don't want to spoil it, but it like there is some good that came out of it, sort of.
Yeah, I saw an interview. It was on like NBC or something, and he was in it. So I'm sure he got paid for that, which is
yes,
nice.
Hopefully.
And it may just be his Japanese stoicism, but he seemed okay.
Yes, that's sort of something he talked about was like, I was not okay for a long time, but I'm okay now.
And it takes a little while, right? So have patience, everybody, with Britney Spears. She'll come out of it. She'll get good. She'll be okay with it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And in 25 years, she'll do another documentary and be better. And it'll still be something that we all watch. Next link.
Next link. All right. I want to bring to you today, from The Hustle, the story and the wild tale of the man who founded Rainforest Cafe.
Oh, I've never been there, but I have heard of it.
I think I went in there once. There was a whole bunch of birds in there. And yeah.
Yeah, it's got a lot of decor, is my understanding.
That's right. And listen, if you were a kid who grew up in the 90s, it was always this alluring, mystical, like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really rough path to get there because it wasn't just a kitschy tourist trap. It was a money minting machine.
Mm.
A single location could gross $15 million in a year.
Wow.
And 3 decades later, there are still 23 locations all over the world. Yes, you can
really?
Go to a Rainforest Cafe today. But the man who had to create the concept had to, as the article notes, navigate a jungle of his own.
But
That's right. This is a man named Steven Schessler, and he was raised in a working class family. Got his first job in 1962 at the age of 7, shoveling snow for neighbors. By the time he was 16, he'd worked a bunch of odd jobs. At 18, he moved to Miami. But what he really wanted was to work in the radio biz.
Hmm.
Not in the Amazon? I was expecting that he wanted to work in the rainforest. Nope, not yet.
On radio.
According to him, during his shifts, he would scale the poles, plug into random telephone lines, and call around for jobs. Which
what?
Yeah, that's a quote according to him. He would scale the poles, plug into random telephone lines, and call around for jobs. And after my shifts, I'd clean up, put my suit on, and go to interviews. Now, as you can imagine, this strategy didn't yield a lot of success for him, so he decided to, quote, take matters into his own hands. He built a giant crate and had a friend seal him inside. Then he had himself delivered to the office of WGBS Radio under the guise that it was an important furniture delivery for one of the executives.
Whoa.
Isn't this a Mr. Beast video?
I think it was in that Japanese show we were just talking about.
Yeah.
All right. So a quote, according to Mr. Schussler here, he opened the crate and I came flying out like a jack in the box. I could hardly breathe. He said, son, you're the sickest person I've ever met. And he hired me as a salesman.
Oh, see, okay. That you reward bad behavior, and that's how you get bad.
We're starting to zero in on American culture here.
Yeah.
But he soon got the bug to start his own thing. So when he was working in advertising, he took up a hobby restoring 1950s ephemera. In doing so, he struck up a partnership with the nightclub and developed a 1950s-themed eatery decorated with all the collectibles.
Mm.
This business eventually branded itself as Jukebox Saturday Night. It was, however, quite successful. It expanded to 7 locations, including one in Minneapolis, where he soon settled and bought a home. Now, pour one out for Jukebox Saturday Night, because it did, in fact, go bankrupt in 1991. But this taste of success had gotten to him, and it wasn't long until he was ready to try his hand again in the restaurant business. So, the early 1990s, developers were interested in restaurants that achieved what they were calling The Trinity of Synergy, which I just threw up in my mouth a little saying that.
Okay. Yeah.
This is describing a combination of dining, retail, and entertainment.
It's on the heels of like Planet Hollywood and stuff, right? And that's
nailed
the same era.
That's exactly right. And these were dubbed Eatertainment. And these restaurants were destinations in their own right. The hope was they attract more out-of-town customers to malls, which were already experiencing a bit of a lull after the 80s, where they had a decade of solid growth. Mm-hmm. And several chains already had millions with this model. As Bradley already noted, we got Planet Hollywood, Hard Rock Cafe, and Schussler had an idea of his own. Quote, I'd always loved animals and tropical birds, and I wondered, what if I could create a rainforest-themed restaurant where I could share all of these amazing creatures with the public while they were eating?
I do believe the rainforest is known for its cuisine.
Right.
Right, and its ambiance very conducive to just losing yourself in a meal. Absolutely. Schussler pitched the idea to business contacts, but nobody was biting. So he turned to Plan B. The entrepreneur sold nearly everything he owned and began to build a man-made rainforest inside his 3,000-square-foot home in a quiet suburb outside of Minneapolis. His electric bill was so high, $2,000 per month, that Drug Enforcement Administration officers actually showed up at his door suspecting a weed-growing operation. The humidity alone destroyed his wallpaper. The gas company shut off his service. Neighbors, of course, constantly complained. Building this project took 3 years, and it cost him $400,000, his entire life savings from the previous ventures. So what he would do now that he's got this mechanized rainforest inside the house, he would invite investors to his home each week for a tour. Quote, I was overwhelmed, one potential investor later told the Star Tribune. You just knew that anybody this crazily committed had to be successful, which
had to be obnoxious to work with.
Yeah.
Eventually, he courted the casino magnate and venture capitalist Lyle Berman. Now, Berman declined to invest, but interestingly, he continued to visit the home, and often he would bring along a colleague or a family member to marvel at the sights and sounds of the suburban jungle. He told me, there's no way you're getting my money, but do you mind if I bring my kids over? I want them to see what it's like to never give up, to be so invested that you live in your concept. And after several years of toggling back and forth on the idea, Berman finally decided to give Schussler a shot. He organized a fundraising round and put up $1.2 million.
Wow.
Now, the first Rainforest Cafe opened its doors in October 1994 in Bloomington, Minnesota, at the Mall of America.
Minnesota.
Well, it's the largest shopping mall in the U.S., so you want to get your entertainment mall concept started, this is where you're going to go. But not an easy feat, because no expense was spared for the robotic creatures, and the restaurant ordered dozens. By the way, a single mechanical elephant, talking about $20,000 for one of those puppies.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Back in the day, too.
Back in the day, yeah. Now, the live parrots that roamed around the restaurant were an even bigger hassle because Schussler had to consult with federal and state health officials and install a special filtration system just to get clearances.
Yeah, but birds poop. Like,
yes.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Special filtration system. Listen, just having the birds in an approved capacity cost the restaurant upwards of $100,000 each year to feed and care for. The staffing needs alone for this. They had to staff a director of operations just to run the technical back end, not to mention the animal handlers for the live animals. But listen, the efforts paid off. The restaurant grossed $15 million in its first year. That was about 5 to 7 times what chains like TGI Fridays or Olive Garden were pulling in. Mm-hmm. And like Hard Rock Cafe or Planet Hollywood, around 25% of Rainforest Cafe's revenue came from the retail, which you had to walk through just to get to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Kids were buying stuffed animals, t-shirts, puppets by the truckload. In 1996, the chain opened a flagship location at Walt Disney World Resort in Orlando, Florida. This one cost for a flagship cost $12 million to build.
Yeah, Disney's going to do it right. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Within 5 years of opening, Rainforest Cafe had over 30 locations all over the world, making it the most lucrative restaurant in the nation on a per store basis. And yeah, as you can imagine, the stock price reflected a lot of that success. From 1995 to 1998, sales rose nearly 100% year over year. But by the turn of the millennium, the numbers were starting to falter. This is when we started to see Planet Hollywood filing for bankruptcy. Investors feared a similar fate for Rainforest Cafe, which had high operating costs and was experiencing declining revenues. Quote, it was a fire sale, according to Schuessler, but then it was on to the next thing. After the sale of his beloved Rainforest Cafe, he went on to found Schuessler Creative. What is it? Well, it's a firm that develops theme restaurants, because of course, much like he once did in his own home, he just does it for a whole bunch of things. He builds out full prototypes of his ideas in a warehouse now in Minnesota. Post-Rainforest Cafe launches include three popular themed restaurants at Walt Disney World in Florida. That would be the T-Rex Cafe. That's a dino-themed restaurant. It's got life-sized animatronic dinosaurs, woolly mammoths, and simulated meteor showers, which I gotta say, I might want to dine there. Then they've got something called Yak and Yeti, a Nepalese-style restaurant adorned with Southeast Asian artifacts. I hope they're replicas or that they were ethically sourced. And the Boathouse, an eatery outfitted with vintage boats. And listen, before you scoff, it earned $43.8 million in sales last year and is one of the highest earning independent restaurants in America, period.
Well, and it makes sense that it's at Disney. Like, these things fit in perfectly with the kind of person who the customer base has already come to you.
Yes.
Not everybody wants to go to the Mall of America anymore, but people are still going to Disney.
Yeah.
He could make his living making just restaurants for Disney for the rest of his life.
Honest to God, it sounds like that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
But it's not like the Rainforest Cafe has disappeared completely. Remember, it is still in operation. It has 23 locations internationally. It may be a little different than what you may remember if you had visited in its heyday during the 90s.
It's all been stripped for cobalt mining.
Right.
Oh, it's just staffed with orphans. No. In 2016, the original location at the Mall of America was moved from the first floor to the third floor. You will not see live parrots flying free anymore. Also, fish tanks, waterfalls, misting machines, they've quietly been phased out. But for Schuessler, it was worth it. He's got a book called It's a Jungle in there. We finished the article with his quote, "There's a fine line between crazy and passionate, but sometimes you just have to build a rainforest in your house."
Yeah, it seems like he would have been really happy to just go work for Weta Workshop, too, at some point in time of his life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's sort of a sculptor and a creator.
And a bit of a troll.
Oh, he just needed
to mail himself to New Zealand, pop out, try to get rid of me now. All right, next link.
Next link.
Let's start with a question. Do y'all have any shows that you just felt gutted when they were ended? Like you lost a family member or a close friend?
A little bit. Better Call Saul. I felt that way. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not alone. This comes from Fizz.org. Fans of long-running TV show experience grief similar to losing a close friend when show ended, study finds.
Oh. No, it's been quantified. Yeah.
Yes. A psychologist at CQ University in Australia has found that some fans of the long-running TV show Neighbors have experienced grief similar to the experience of losing a close friend. Those of us in the U.S. Will have no idea, but Neighbors was a long-running Australian soap opera that was in the air from 1985 to 2022. That's 37 years of it being on. Longer than most of the relationships that many of the viewers had in real life.
Yeah.
So in his study, Adam Gerace analyzed surveys taken by over 1,289 people. Oh, I like that number, too.
Right. So 1,290? Is that what I'm hearing?
Anecdotal evidence suggests that fans of television shows often feel a connection with characters and experience a sense of loss when a show ends. To better understand that sense of loss, he asked volunteers to fill out online surveys regarding how they felt about the show ending. It also asked about the degree of acceptance that the show had really ended and whether they felt closure as the show ended. And finally, it asked whether they felt any gratitude for those who had been involved in this production. Ooh. And in looking at the responses, Gracie found that they're still having problems with it.
Wow.
He noted also that such feelings appeared to be stronger in people who had formed, quote, parasocial relationships with the characters.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. Many of them thought of the characters as a friend of a sort, or at least an extended part of their social group. And I think this happens with YouTubers and TikTok influencers probably more often, because the fans become even more part of their lives and really feel their... a close friend?
Right. Well, and they know on some level Neighbors is fiction, regardless of anything else, whereas this YouTuber might really be your real friend someday. You know, you convince yourself. Yeah.
So according to the survey, it's okay to feel sad when your favorite show goes, or at least it's perfectly natural in an unnatural way.
Right. It's expected. How's that?
Yes.
But I have some good news. Don't worry, everyone. When I looked up the show, because I'd never heard of it, it seems they struck a deal to restart production in 2023 with new episodes to stream for free.
Yeah, but you may not like what you get. That's what happened with Gilmore Girls, right? We finally got another season. And everyone's like, oh.
Ooh. Yeah.
Well, listen, zombies are never nice and clean and polite like the living person was. That's just
right.
That's science.
Yeah. And yeah, as much as I was a fan of Arrested Development,
not so much.
Yep. We always remember the flesh as it lived, and we forget to take into account the decay of time.
That's right. There's regrets with Pet Sematary. So
Next link.
All right, next up we have from JSTOR Daily an article called Time in a Box, which is about the history of time capsules. So the term time capsule was coined at the 1939 New York World's Fair, but the concept goes back much further. So historian Nick Yablon refers to these older burials as time vessels. And he says one of the most important distinctions that makes something a time vessel is that it's not about real preservation. The items that go into a time vessel or a time capsule are never rare and are generally quite personal because they're meant to reflect the values of the person or group who is sealing it up. And because of this, he notes, they're often quite disappointing when they do get opened, which is also made worse by the hype, right? Because usually these unveilings are quite public. In 1976, for example, President Ford opened a 100-year-old time capsule that had been put together at the U.S. Centennial Exposition, and the contents included an inkstand, a book on temperance or not drinking alcohol, and some photos of politicians that we already had in various history books. According to news reports at the time, it was, quote, rather a disappointment for those present.
Yeah, I've seen one recently that they just opened up and it was just dirt in there.
Yes. Well, and that happened as well. I wasn't even going to go into it. But in 1986, Geraldo Rivera famously opened up Al Capone's vault.
I remember that. It was on TV, live TV.
Yes. Yeah. They had 2 hours of live TV and like weeks of advertising. And it contained literally nothing except like a couple of empty bottles.
Oh, I remember that.
Now we understand what people like. We are the first people to open this pyramid. Nope. Someone beat you to it, friend.
Yeah, but right, there wasn't anything in this one, though. Like, they just didn't put anything in
it. There was nothing.
Wait, it was never buried without anything? It hadn't even...
No, it just never got looted.
It was just his vault that was closed, and they're like, there must be things in here. So they made a huge deal about it, and then they opened it, and it was like, no, it's empty. We got 2 hours to fill. It was bad. And, you know, you mentioned pyramids. Historian William Jarvis says the modern concept of a time capsule really got going around the 1900s and was likely inspired by the discovery and reopening of various Egyptian tombs that was going on during that time. And those are, of course, several thousand years old. Jarvis says there's a really clear dividing line between short-term and long-term time capsules. People either bury them for 50 to 100 years or over 1,000. But there are almost no time capsules that are meant to be opened between 200 and 900 years in the future.
Oh. I got a business plan.
Yeah, exactly. Build a rainforest in your house. But
I kind of love that disappointment, though, because it indicates what has shifted in that time. For example, like the pictures of politicians. At the time, they could not have envisioned that we would have technology that could reproduce graphics, images, and symbols at mass scale, thus rendering those less valuable than they may have been at the time.
Right. Mm. Well, and that's kind of the Jarvis's point is like, if you hold it long enough, everything becomes interesting. But we almost have this desire of like, yeah, we want to bury it, but we also want to be there when it's opened.
Yeah.
And 100 years is not enough, point.
That's right. If you really want to get on Antiques Roadshow, you got to hit that 200 to 900 mm-hmm. year time for us to have forgotten enough to be properly surprised and delighted.
Well, and there are some people doing it. One of the longest, most ambitious time capsules is called the Crypt of Civilization. It's buried at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta, Georgia. It was sealed in 1940 and is not intended to be opened for over 6,000 years, which is maybe optimistic, but, you know, you got to admire that.
Wait, when did they pack it up? 1940?
Yeah, 1940, they sealed it up. And they did a good job. To make sure it lasts, the 20-foot-long chamber is built with a 2-foot-thick granite floor, a 7-foot-thick ceiling, and the granite walls are lined with vitreous porcelain enamel embedded in pitch. So it's meant to survive, even if humanity doesn't.
So that's where we stuck the alien.
Exactly. Yes. Maybe. Among the hundreds of items they admit to being inside are a model train, a set of Lincoln Logs, male and female mannequins in glass cases, an electric toaster, a pair of stockings, a set of dentures, a plastic flute, a life-size cutaway model of a pregnant woman, and two different types of television. So, like, on the one hand, there seems to be like, yeah, technology. But then also, maybe we've evolved so much we're not really human anymore and we want to see what our anatomy used to look like. I don't know what they're thinking. And not surprisingly, the time capsule craze peaked around 2000 and has been dwindling in recent decades, especially as, like you said, technology allows us greater access to older materials anytime we want them. On the other hand, larger preservation-style crypts have greatly increased in popularity as people tend to worry more now about the actual collapse of civilization, in which case, what survives in the future, like our Egyptian pyramids, may just end up being full of bunker supplies,
yeah.
Right? And that's just for the future to deal with. It's not going to be our choice or our problem. All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include A Senseless Fire and the Stranger Who Put It Out, the Tokyo government is launching its own dating app, and flatulence's surprising role in hormone production. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.